Blog Talk Radio.
As we discussed last week, Charlie Rose and Garrison Keillor are both 75 years old, and they've both been accused of levels of sexual misconduct. Now, some people are talking about charging these septuagenarians with a crime. I'm guessing it's going to be assault with a deadly weapon. The Senate tax bill passed since we last met, and most of the reason it did is because it received a positive vote from Senator Susan Collins of Maine, or at least that's a good part of the reason. She was promised that both the House of Representatives and the Senate would take up the Alexander Murray health care bill, which is designed to improve the Affordable Care Act. She wanted this debated and voted on because of the removal in the Senate tax bill of the so-called individual mandate. After the positive vote on the tax bill, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan said he had no intention of considering Alexander Murray. The lesson is that promises from the Republican leadership are often written in disappearing ink. Also, since we last met, three members of Congress have announced their resignations. Democratic Congressman John Conyers, who was and is a civil rights icon, apparently had trouble keeping something in his pants. Senator Al Franken and Representative Trent Franks have both announced their resignations. Franks reportedly asked one of his women staffers to act as a surrogate and offered her $5 million. Now, suggestions for all you unmarried men, don't try this in a singles bar. After President Trump said that the U.S. would recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, there were a few protests. Now rockets have been sent into Israel from the Palestinian-held Gaza Strip, and Israel is counterattacking. Aren't you glad that the president is aiding peace? Can you imagine what would happen if he wanted to create war and chaos? Francis, the talking pope, is considering changing the wording of the Lord's Prayer. Here's some suggested text. Our Mother, who maybe art in heaven or maybe not, forgive us our sins unless we're in Congress, for thine is the power so long as you've paid your electric bill. Okay, maybe not. And finally, a man in the UK, whose name we won't mention, decided he wanted to draw a lot of views on YouTube. So he poured some quick-drying cement into a microwave oven and stuck his head into the cement, and it was all uploaded to the video site. In the category of what could possibly go wrong, this stunt falls squarely. What happened was that his head got stuck, and his friends couldn't get the microwave oven off his head or him out of the concrete-laden microwave. Eventually, they wasted over an hour of local firefighters' time to get him out. Now, if you ever wondered why no one's ever done something on YouTube, there's probably a good reason. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That is I. Tonight we'll talk about those stories, and we'll have a conversation with author Luke Murphy, and you can participate as well. We'll be giving out our numbers in a little bit. Also, I wanted to mention to you, as I do every week, that if you wish to help support this program, you can do so at patreon.com, patreon.com/Jeff Bushman. With Jeff Bushman all being one word, unlike our podcast site. So again, that's patreon.com/Jeff Bushman, and if you want to throw a couple of shekels our way, it'll be greatly appreciated, and as said, will help to support the show. First off, I wanted to mention that the story about the guy in England who stuck his head in quick-drying concrete in a microwave oven, I was reminded when I was discussing this story that this is reminiscent of a joke told by comic Jeff Foxworthy, which you may have heard, and the basics of it are that you may be a redneck. Oh, many of his jokes start that way. You may be a redneck if. Okay, this one is, you may be a redneck. Any of your relatives have ever died right after saying, watch this. And the moron on YouTube may fit into that same category. Anyway, later on this evening, we'll have Luke Murphy. He'll be joining us in about 28 minutes. Luke is the author of three books, that are very excellent sellers. He's a mystery, or I think he would say thriller writer. And you may have heard of some of the books, Dead Man's Hand, Kiss and Tell, and Wild Card. We'll be talking to him about those books and his methodology in terms of writing and his history. And I think you'll find it interesting, so stick with us, even if you find me boring as hell. Anyway, because Luke will be interesting. And next week we have Larry Hancock for the entire hour. In any event, I also wanted to discuss with you the story about Congress and the resignation. So let me first off state my biases so everything I say afterwards is a little more clear. I don't like Roy Moore. Okay, given. I do like Al Franken and John Conyers. Okay. But there's no question in my mind that John Conyers should have, in fact, resigned. He has been a hero in the civil rights movement. He's a very bright guy, but not bright enough to not go after his staff members and other women in an inappropriate way. And he settled one of those cases with taxpayer money, as I understand it. And above and beyond that, he's just acted inappropriately. He comes from a time in our history where sexual harassment, sexual misconduct by males is kind of expected, but that doesn't make it better. But with Al Franken, I've got some real concerns. I mentioned him last week. One of them was that the first accuser was a woman who may have had a political agenda. Leanne Whedon accused Franken of forcing a kiss on her when they were doing a USO show. And he said he doesn't remember it the same way, meaning I don't think that's what happened. That's what he was effectively saying. But he did acknowledge the photograph that everyone's seen now, where he looks like he looks into the camera while she's sleeping, and his hands are not touching but are near her breasts, as if he's going to grope her as soon as the camera goes off. And he was trying to be funny, and it was stupid, and he is blameworthy for that, although I don't think it rises to the level of a resignation offense. But we need to talk about something that may at first seem unconnected, so let me do that now. James O'Keefe is a name you may or may not be familiar with, but James O'Keefe was convicted of a crime involving, I don't know all the details, but it involved basically pretending to be somebody else and then getting into a senator's office that way. I don't remember all the details, but what he is involved in generally is what might be called conservative guerrilla theater. And by that, what I mean and what he does is he goes into situations where he tries to entrap people who are liberal and make them look foolish or criminal. And to give you one example in terms of the foolish part, he caused the posting of a video in which an African-American woman who was in charge of a federal government program involving farm subsidies appeared to say that she discriminated against white farmers. And it later came out that there was a fuller tape, and the fuller tape, the unedited version, showed that she wasn't saying anything of the kind. O'Keefe had edited and cut the recording so that it looked like she was making a racist argument, if you will. Okay. A more recent occurrence was after the Washington Post did yeoman work, perhaps we should say yo person, yeoman work on the Roy Moore story and scandal. In terms of, or scandals, I should say, involving young women when he was already an adult male, the O'Keefe organization sent a woman to the Washington Post, and she was claiming that Roy Moore made her pregnant and was a predator and all this other stuff. They were trying to get, or the woman was trying to get the Post to report what she said. And she was asking if this would hurt Moore and so forth in the election. The Post, to their credit, when they were doing the vetting, if you will, of the story she was trying to pass off, realized that the evidence she was presenting was insufficiently reliable. So they would not publish the story. And then later they found out that she was working for O'Keefe's organization. Then the reason I'm mentioning this is as follows. The first story that came out about Al Franken was from this talk show host in Los Angeles. And it was not reported at the time, but the radio station is a very conservative radio station, KABC Radio. They used to be, when I was a kid and lived in Los Angeles, they used to be the opposite. They were a very liberal radio station, or at least somewhat. And they basically started making changes when Rush Limbaugh was kicking the butt of their liberal morning host. So Leanne Whedon works at that radio station. And on last week's show, when we were talking about this, I said, whatever else Leanne Whedon may or may not be, she is certainly no great liberal if she's working for KABC. Okay? So So we said that then. Now, in the meantime, it was revealed, not because I'm so clever, but just because that was logical and there was more information. It turns out that she's also a great pal of Sean Hannity. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean she's lying, but it does make her report a little suspicious, okay? And even though she said she had no desire for Franken to resign his Senate seat, the fact that she brought this up does suggest they had an agenda. Another thing in terms of agenda, prior to Leanne Whedon's story coming out, there is a Trump, associate, friend, advocate, henchman by the name of Roger Stone. Roger Stone has a really interesting history, which we don't have time to get into, but Roger Stone, prior to Leanne Whedon coming out, said when they were talking to him about Roy Moore, he said, he laughed and he said, well, don't worry, Franken's next. If Leanne Whedon was not a setup, and assuming that Stone wasn't just joking, which is possible, how would he know that? Okay. Now, the other women who came out about Franken recently, the one who was from the congressional aide, the woman who was a congressional aide and said Franken forced a kiss on her after interviewing her when he was on Air America. He forcibly kissed her, and when she objected, he said, that's my right as an entertainer. As he correctly pointed out, that's a ridiculous thing to say, and he said it never happened and he didn't say it. Do I believe him? I don't know. I think so, but I don't know. And the fact that all these other women came out, the one woman who I really believe was the woman who first came out with the Minnesota State Fair photo where she said that Franken, you know, put his arm around her and his hand slipped down to her butt. Possible. I think it's possible it was accidental and it's possible it was on purpose. I don't pretend to know. But I think a lot of these, the woman who went to the Washington Post with regard to Roy Moore to try to get the Post to publish a false story about Roy Moore was a put-up, obviously. Okay. And I'm just wondering if some or all of these other women, again, with the exception of Leanne Whedon, who did it for political reasons, and the one woman who I think makes perfectly logical sense about his hand going down to her butt, what if all of these other women who have come forward about Al Franken were people who were either paid or at least motivated by conservatives who wanted to make Franken look bad and drive him out of the Senate? You have to remember, Al Franken has been a very effective senator, particularly in his questioning and proving the perjury of Jeff Sessions, our attorney general, or at least the attorney general of the United States. I don't want to claim it, frankly. So that's what you've got. The problem here is this. We have gone from a situation in the United States where when it comes to women complaining about sexual harassment, we've gone from the point of believe no one and nothing to believe everyone and everything. The truth is that women have for too long been disbelieved when they claimed sexual harassment. I believe that most women who complain about sexual harassment are telling the truth. Okay? I'm just not sure about this because it seems so weird. It just seems so off. And I'm mentioning this now in the hopes that if and when it comes out that this is the case and that Franken has been martyred effectively on the altar of equality, that someone will remember the fact that at least it was brought up by somebody, not necessarily me. My ego is not involved. Okay, not too much. But, you know, the fact is that when you had all these Democratic women calling for Franken's resignation, I understand it because, again, they are saying, believe the women who are claiming harassment. And essentially it's because women have been disbelieved for so long, for so many years. So I understand the rationale behind their position. I just disagree with it. I think what should have happened is, as should happen with Moore, by the way, if he is, heaven forbid, elected, is there ought to be a Senate Ethics Committee hearing and investigation. They should do the investigation, and if it turns out that there's good evidence to believe that Franken is a sexual predator, fine, boot him. If there is not, and respectfully, I believe there probably is not, then at that point, you know, everything go away. This is nonsense. So, obviously, time will tell. But or it may not. It may be that once he's out of the Senate, which is going to happen in the next couple of weeks, that no one will have a particular interest in investigating this any further. There you have that. In the meantime, I mentioned Susan Collins. Susan Collins is a senator from Maine. She voted against the Obamacare repeal along with John McCain and one other senator, and I can't remember who that was. But she voted against that and because she didn't want so many people to be without coverage. So what happened more recently is she decided to vote in favor of the Senate tax bill that recently passed because she was told that the Senate and the House would then take up the Alexander Murray bill. The Alexander Murray bill is offered by Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee and Patty Murray from Washington. And essentially, I don't understand all of the bill, but at least a good part of it, it is for the purpose of repairing Obamacare, or at least continuing things in the various states until such point as it can be replaced. And as soon as the tax bill was passed by the Senate, essentially Paul Ryan said, we're not going to take it up. Now, what's the effect of all that? Well, it's hard to know, obviously. But what's happening now is there is a conference committee going on between members of the House and members of the Senate. They're supposed to come up with a bill that mixes elements of both of the tax bills, one in the House and one in the Senate, and then it has to pass both of those houses again. I can almost guarantee, well, I can't almost guarantee you, that's nonsense. I strongly believe that if it comes, or when it comes back to the Senate, assuming the House-Senate Conference Committee is successful, and I assume it will be, when they come back to the Senate with their bill, their tax bill, I'm guessing that Susan Collins is going to vote against it. I believe that Bob Corker is also probably going to vote against it. And if they can get one more vote, everything becomes smooth. By the way, there's also a possibility, since the election in Alabama is next, I'm trying to remember, I think it's the 12th, so that's about 4 days away. That would be Tuesday. If that vote takes place and Doug Jones, by some miracle, should win, and the tax bill does not make it back to the Senate before Doug Jones is seated, well, that changes the dynamic pretty significantly because then the majority is 51 to 49. It's now 52-48, in case it's not obvious. So 51-49, which means if they lose two votes, they're done. They lose one, heaven forbid, talk about blast from the past. If it's a tie, Vice President Mike Pence, who is nothing like Dick Cheney except they're both the same party and crazy. Mike Pence can go ahead and break the tie, and therefore it'll pass. But if it's 51, if they lose two votes, therefore they only have 49, Pence can't do anything. This assumes that Doug Jones is elected instead of Roy Moore, which nobody thinks is going to happen, including me. I think Roy Moore is going to win in Alabama. That is my fearless prediction. Should I also add at this point that I predicted that Hillary Clinton would not only get the majority of the popular vote, but would win the election in 2016? Okay, I'm not always right. Okay, all right. Anyway, in about 8-9 minutes, Luke Murphy, who I almost called Luke Murray just now, after the Alexander Murray healthcare bill, Luke will be joining us, and you can now, if you wish to, call in. Well, actually, I'm going to wait until after Luke is with us because I want to talk to him and I want to interrupt him with calls. But after that, you'll be able to call in, I believe. We'll see about that shortly. Anyway, that's pretty much that. In the meantime, I wanted to talk briefly about today, about not today's day. Oh, by the way, happy birthday, Mom. Today is my mother's 95th. In terms of yesterday's date, you've been hearing a lot about Pearl Harbor Day and all of that. One of the things that, and as a side note, if you get a chance to listen to a podcast of All Things Considered on NPR today, there was a horrible report. I mean, it was good journalism, but it was a horrible report. There was a woman who was a survivor of the Hiroshima nuclear attack. And if you hear that, it's both shocking and devastating in terms of what a nuclear blast can do to people. Obviously kill them, but even among those who don't die, it's horrible. It, I believe, was first John Kennedy who said that if there were a nuclear war, the living will envy the dead. And her testimony kind of brings that idea forward quite a bit. In any event, that's that. Very briefly mention, so the December 7th. December 7th, 1941 was Pearl Harbor Day, as almost everybody knows. That was the day that the Japanese Imperial Air Force went ahead and attacked the United States at Pearl Harbor. And in any event, that was obviously a horrible occurrence. Actually, 9/11 had a greater death toll than Pearl Harbor did. But at the time, Pearl Harbor was the greatest single disaster that we had ever experienced, of course. And the reason I was mentioning that is because over 2,000 soldiers died. Really quite amazing. So, checking here on some numbers, so forgive me if I sound distracted. Also, by the way, please forgive me if the sound quality is not that good. We are tonight, the phone we normally use for this broadcast is down, so we're using a cell phone, and sound quality, as everybody knows who's ever spoken on a cell phone, is not as good. So there you are. In any event, as I said, Luke will be joining us shortly. Let's see. We have also to apologies. I was talking about Pearl Harbor. One of the things we learned about Pearl Harbor is obviously don't put all of your resources in one place because you're going to run the risk, of course, that it can be damaged. One of the reasons I'm mentioning that is because obviously since then no country pretty much has done that, including and especially our own. But there is some conversation now going around in defense circles about the possibility of getting rid of our land-based missiles because they are prone to attack and deterioration and some other things. That may be something we end up talking to Larry Hancock about next week. But in any event, the fact is that the land-based missiles are far more vulnerable than the ocean-based and airplane-based missiles that we have about. There was also an organization that was featured in that NPR story with regard to the I'm trying to think what I was going to say about the attack. There's an organization that is gunning for, if you'll pardon the poor, terrible choice of words, but that is attempting to get rid of all nuclear weapons. And while one might think about that as being a very noble and positive thing, frankly, I'm not sure. If you think about it, before World War I, there was another war that was seen as like a world war between major powers at the time. It lasted for a long time. I think they referred to it as the Hundred Years' War. And then ultimately it ended with a treaty. And then World War I occurred beginning in 1914 in Europe and 1917 and 18 for the United States. And then, of course, World War II, starting in 1939 in Europe and 1941, obviously for us, with the beginning of Pearl Harbor, or with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. But since World War II, this is the longest period in a very, very, very long time without a world war. And then we elected Trump. But that joke aside, the thing is that we've gone a long time without a world war, and there are a lot of people who believe that the reason for that has to do with the fact that nuclear weapons are now in the mix, and have been since just after World War II. The reality that any major world war, if it goes to nuclear weapons, and it likely would, I think, and again, my credentials are rather slim, but more importantly, a lot of people who know a lot more than I do believe that the reason we haven't had a world war is because of nuclear weapons. Everyone's afraid of a major war, and of course we have the UN now, which tends to allow us to tamp down the kinds of things that would lead us to a world war by speaking instead of fighting. Again, a lot of people believe that the reason that we haven't had one of those major wars is because we talk more because we're all afraid of a worldwide war. So there you are. One moment, please. Okay, I wanted to make sure we were still connected. We are waiting for Luke Murphy to call in, and I expect that to happen momentarily, and then we'll bring him right on. Okay, so you won't have to just listen to boring old me. So that basically is that. Let me go ahead and invite you to call in, because apparently Luke is a little late, so we'll see what happens with that. If you'd like to talk about anything we've discussed so far or anything else, please feel free to call in at 646-668-2953. While we have a moment, let me do another little commercial type of thing. We mentioned Patreon.com, but let me also mention that besides the writer we're going to interview tonight, and hopefully, and next week as well, is I also have a few books up on Amazon. If you're interested, you can just check out Amazon.com and look for, by my full first name, Jefferson, last name Bushman, B-U-S-H-M-A-N. The book that we've written that is probably the one that sells the most is something called The Mobile Millionaire, and that's a book about investing in mobile homes, and talks about buying them, renting them out, how cheaply you can do it, and so forth. So let me invite you to go to Amazon and pick that up. It's an ebook. But I think you may, if you're interested in that at all, you may find it interesting. Let me tell you a little bit about Luke Murphy. Luke Murphy is a former hockey player who has now written three books, Dead Man's Hand, Kiss and Tell, and Wild Card. Luke is a Canadian, but in spite of that, we like him. How are you, Luke?
Oh, I'm great, Jeff. How are you?
I'm great. Did you hear
that introduction?
It's a great
intro.
I thought you might like that. Well, first off, let me mention to our vast audience, I mean, I think all three people are listening now, but Luke and I have talked a couple of times before in earlier series of podcasts we've done, and it's been about 3 years, maybe more, 4 years maybe, since we last spoke. So I assume everything is going well with you.
Everything is going well. Unfortunately, my wife and kids don't let me write too much, so I only have a book out every 3 years or so. So that's why I think we...
Yeah, well, you know, life happens, right?
Exactly, yeah, very busy.
Okay, well, first off, I mentioned that you used to be a hockey player, and as I recall, you played briefly in the pros, did you know?
I did. Geez, it seems like a lifetime ago now, but it must be 20 years ago now. I signed a contract with the Florida Panthers, so I had a brief cup of coffee, you could say, up with them for 4 games, and spent the rest of my career in the minor leagues, their farm system, bouncing around and playing hockey for about 6 seasons. So it was a lot of fun, but, you know, like I said, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, I understand. You know, I don't have that kind of history. I mean, first off, you know, I grew up in Southern California where until, you know, fairly far along, we didn't, you know what the hell hockey was. But the thing I was going to say is, although I am somewhat more athletic now, when I was a kid, I was the fat, short kid with glasses who nobody picked for their team. So I don't have a history like that. The only thing I had major league status in maybe was U.S. history, but that's about
there
it.
There you go.
So after you left the sports world, did you go immediately into writing, or did you do some things in between?
Well, actually, I kind of started writing when I was playing hockey, which was, you know, like as I tell people, it's not exactly the route that most authors take. It was actually my second year of pro, and I ended up getting an injury, which was a season-ending injury, and so I had all this time on my hands living down in Oklahoma City. I didn't really know anyone outside of the hockey team, and, you know, I couldn't travel with them or play with them and stuff, and so I always was an avid reader. I always loved reading, had books with me all the time, and my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, and she was attending university, and she had to write a story for one of her classes, and she asked me to help her out with it because she knew I liked reading. And, you know, I helped her set, you know, over email and stuff, and we plotted things out and talked about characters and had a lot of fun with that. So once we were done with that, I actually took one of the characters we had created and just started writing a story of my own on my free time. So it really started out as a hobby while I played hockey, and then obviously, after hockey ended, I got a little more serious after that.
Did I understand correctly that which you started to write, which you didn't think much of, is the one that ended up in the book Kiss and Tell?
Yes, that is correct. That very first story I ever wrote that I didn't think would go anywhere. It was just kind of almost like I said, it was a hobby at that time. It was practice. I was new. I, you know, didn't really have any formal training in writing or anything, just from what I took in school. And, you know, so that was really just, you know, honing my craft at that time. And, you know, like I said, it was more of a practice, but stayed on the computer for about, 10 years or so before I brought it back out and revamped it for a Kiss and Tell.
Yeah, I understand. I was going to say, I have an old CPM computer. You know what CPM was?
Yeah.
CPM, for those who don't know, was the basic operating system for desktop computers that was really the first, and it was not only pre-Windows, it was pre-DOS, which would give you an idea of how long ago that was. But yeah, but I, on one of those old computers, I have a book I will never retrieve because it was awful, and it really was. When did you get around to writing Dead Man's Hand? That was the first one you had published, was it not?
Yes, that's correct. So I started writing that in, I think, 2005 or 2006. After I had written a couple of manuscripts, well, I guess you could say for fun, but as a practice, and I decided to get serious, I took a full year off from writing, just kind of research the industry, bought books about writing, read up about it, made friends in the industry, whether agents or authors, you know, peppered them all with questions just to find out a little bit before I actually sat down and started writing notes. And once I was prepared and had, you know, 6 or 7 pages of notes of what I wanted to write about, I sat down. So it was probably 2006 six or maybe, yeah, around there, somewhere around there, I started writing it. Because I remember, you know, I hooked up with an editor in 2007 and worked with him for another year or so on the manuscript. So it was probably took about 2 years for the first draft, and then another year after that.
Wow.
So, yeah. But that's working around, you know, full-time jobs and family commitments,
right,
and stuff. So,
but
unfortunately,
paid your
dues. I didn't get to write. Well, absolutely. It was a long haul. So, and it wasn't published till 2012. So when you think about it, it was probably a six-year process from the first, you know, writing, sitting down to write the first word to when it came out as a published book.
Yes. By the way, Luke just proved what I said earlier when he pronounced process. He is Canadian. Anyway, for our American audience. So tell our audience the essentials of the plot of Dead Man's Hand, which was a bestseller around the world.
Yeah. So Dead Man's Hand, it's about a former NCAA football standout at USC who's winning Heisman trophies, who's on the road to stardom of being a first overall draft choice and making, you know, millions of dollars in the NFL. And in his junior season, he has this devastating knee injury, and you know, he kind of spirals down the ladder. He loses a scholarship, finds himself living on the streets of Vegas, where he picks up a job as a collector for a bookie. And, you know, he lives that life for 3 years where, you know, it's kind of like a leg breaker. So he gets that reputation. So he doesn't like himself. He wants out of that life. And just as he's trying to get out, he's framed for murder. And so the story of Dead Man's Hand is Calvin Waters, my main character, trying to prove his innocence while he's avoiding the cops. A hired hitman comes on the scene to try to silence him for what he knows about the murder. So the basic plot of it is Calvin trying to find the real killer, keeping away from the cops while proving his innocence.
Right. Okay. And Dead Man's Hand refers to something in poker, doesn't it?
It does. It's funny because it wasn't the original title I had planned for the book that was... You know, the title changed three times, first with me, and then my agent wanted something different, and then the publisher wanted something different. So we all came to agreement on Dead Man's Hand because it is a reference to the Wild West, a poker game in the Wild West, and it's a hand, a card hand, you know. It's funny because
right.
I teach high school, and a lot of people, Dead Man's Hand, is there an actual picture of a hand on the, you know, like a person's hand on the book? But it's actually a card hand from Wild Bill back
poker.
in the Wild West.
Do you recall what the poker hand is?
It's two aces and two eights. And
okay,
really
and that's the hand that Wild Bill Hickok had when he was killed, right?
That's correct. That's why it became known as the Dead Man's Hand. He was holding those four cards when he was killed in a saloon. And apparently they don't know for sure what that fifth card ever was. I mean, there's speculation about different cards it was. But to this day, there's no set, you know, exact reference to what that fifth card was. So right now, Dead Man's Hand is known as aces and eights. So
yeah,
two aces and two eights. Yeah.
Yeah, it could have been a full house, which is three of one kind and two of another for anyone who doesn't know, or it could have been a useless card that nobody knows, as you said.
Exactly. It's never been confirmed.
Okay. And you mentioned your character, Calvin Waters. He was not involved in Kiss and Tell, but was he also involved in Wild Card?
He is. Wild Card is a sequel to Dead Man's Hand. So Wild Card was just released in October, and it follows Calvin again, and it really is almost like a runoff from Dead Man's Hand. So it kind of ended Dead Man's Hand with a bit of a cliffhanger for readers. We find out there's more involved in the murder than what people thought. So right at the end, we found it, you know, there's still somebody who was involved in the murder. And so Wild Card kind of, you know, the detectives
picks
reopened the case. pick up from there. And so the killer who was arrested in Dead Man's Hand, he escapes prison in Wild Card. So Calvin has to go on the hunt for him, and the chase ends up down in South America, and so we cross over continents and countries, and so it really is a lot more action in Wild Card, I think, than, you know, Dead Man's Hand is a lot of police investigation, whereas somebody on Amazon said that Wild Card is like Jason Bourne meets John Rambo. So it's, you know, there's certainly a lot going on in Wild Card.
Yeah, you end up doing a fair amount of research for your novels, do you not?
I do. For Dead Man's Hand, I actually took a couple of trips to Vegas, you know, my research trips, I called them. My wife laughs at that, but went to Vegas for a reason.
Yeah, I don't know anything about Canadian tax law. I don't even know that much about U.S. tax law. But I, at least in this country, that would have been deductible.
Yeah, it sure is. My wife would like me to write a book in Hawaii
about a story in Hawaii, and do
a research. But yeah, so I worked with the Vegas Police Department, and I work with, depending on what's going on, you know, anything to do with medical. I work with a doctor here in my hometown, and like I said, lots of different police departments I've worked with. So I really do research, and you know, you're trying to. I know it's fiction, but you want it to be as realistic as possible, and it's a lot more fun. I know as a reader myself, I like it when it's a lot more fun, when it's a lot more realistic. Than even though we do know we're reading fiction, you kind of want that realistic touch on it.
Yeah, I listen. You know, I understand it. I am in the group of millions of people who dropped out of law school. Okay, and I know when I see something on one of these legal shows, well, I used to be a big fan of L.A. Law, and as an example, and when I see something which is so obviously false, and my wife used to work as a nurse, so the medical shows are the same thing with her. You know, you watch these shows and you see where they have either no idea what they're talking about, or they have taken such an enormous liberty with reality that it becomes disturbing to watch. And the same thing is true of books, of course. You know, and
absolutely.
If something doesn't ring true, you begin to wonder, you know, one of the things that happens in fiction, as you know, whether it's a movie or a book, is you want the reader or watcher, audience, to suspend disbelief. But if you bring in something that just rings a very false note, that begins to get lost in there a little bit. That is, the audience tends to, if not literally put the book down or walk out of the movie, at least they're looking at it with a little bit less enthusiasm. And obviously your research tends to eliminate that.
Absolutely. Like you said, I mean, I'm sure that, you know, even when policeman or someone, detective, whatever, picks up my book, they might, you know, catch something in there that, you know, probably wouldn't happen. But like I said, you want to work with the professionals who are going to help you, try to get rid of that stuff. And even editors, I know editors, the editors I have, they do a great job too. They're always really nitpicking, and they'll always comment, like, could this really happen type thing. So they're always just checking for stuff that might be a little out of place where it should be.
Well, you said Wild Card came out in October. How is it doing? Of course, that's a really stupid question, because if we're doing lousy, what would you say? But overall, how is it doing, say, as compared to Dead Man's Hand at the same time frame after publication?
I think it's probably pretty close. I mean, I'm putting off retirement another 20 years, so I don't think I'll be retiring anytime soon from my books.
Yeah, well,
I tell my wife I'll have to teach until I die. So,
are you teaching now?
Pardon?
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to step on you. I said, are you teaching now in addition to writing?
Yeah, my full time job is I'm a high school teacher. I teach here at the high school in town, so that's my number one job. And then I tutor in the evenings, and then I also ref hockey at night. So I've got a few jobs going, and I guess most writers, you know, kind of go through that. The starving writer, people talk about,
sure.
But I think some of us have a bunch of jobs to kind of, we can pay for our hobbies, our vices,
well,
I
yeah,
guess we
but,
could call
but,
them.
But the truth of the matter is, Dead Man's Hand, at least, was a bestseller, and I don't know what the status is of Wild Card. And obviously there's some income, but it's not like you get rich even with a bestseller.
Well,
you
yeah, that, and
them over time.
That's the thing I don't like about that term bestseller. I think people think, oh, my gosh, this guy makes millions of dollars, right? But, you know, bestseller, it's kind of – I don't know if anyone knows exactly how a book becomes a bestseller. I know it sells really well over a short period of time. Like,
right.
You know, I don't think we know the exact summary of how – when it, but – you know, it takes a short period and how many books you can sell in a short period of time. But, you know, overall, that doesn't mean you're you know, it's a bestseller is a lot different than I think than like a New York Times bestseller. You know, that's
yeah, right.
I think
that's a different story.
That's what
yeah.
all authors strive for, I believe, is that NYT, those letters up there before bestseller. But, no, I mean, look, I have no, you know, my expectations aren't through the ceiling there. I know that I'm just getting going, really. You know, it is my third book out, but I know it, my name isn't, you know, I'm not a King or a Patterson or anyone like that.
Right.
It takes time. It takes a long time to get your name out there and get recognized in the book industry. I mean, there's a billion books on Amazon alone. I mean, it's just crazy.
Right.
It takes time to build the readership and... You know, I'm certainly not in this to get rich, because if I was, I would have stopped writing long ago, right? I'm passionate about writing. I mean, my wife, she can't believe that, you know, the time I write is like 9 o'clock at night when everyone's gone to bed and all my jobs are done. And, you know, I try to stay up as late as I can, even if I'm a little tired, I try to work through it. It's just, and she says, why do you do that yourself? And, you know, I love writing. It doesn't feel, it's not a job, right? When it's something I do when I want to do. Pardon?
Yeah. I said, I'm with you. I agree 100%.
Yeah.
You know,
that's it, right?
As you may recall, I have a few books up on Amazon. They're ebooks, and if you don't
yeah,
recall it,
absolutely.
I forgive you. But the point I make, and I've got two books I'm working on now, both of which are nonfiction. One is about what I do for a living, which is process serving, which seems to be interesting to people for reasons I don't fully understand. And the other one has to do with health and weight loss. But the point I was going to make is, you're right. Most people who are really I don't want to say good, because I don't want to sound egotistical, but most people who really end up being successful writing do so not because they're trying to make a living doing it. They do so because what you just said, and it sounds odd, is that we're passionate about writing. We're writing not because specifically we want to, although that's, you know, very nice, but because on some level we have to.
Yes, yes. Yeah,
you
just
know,
something
and,
in us that, yeah.
Yeah, it's a compulsion. it's obviously a neurosis that we share. But it's difficult. One of the things that you may find interesting, which I did, is I read a statistic. I'm trying to remember what the number is now, and I don't. About the average number of books that a writer who has a book in bookstores sells per year. And now I remember. Okay. In other words. If some guy writes a book and puts it in a bookstore, you know, gets it published by a publisher, gets into a bookstore, how many books on average does that person sell a year? And the number is like 12.
Okay? Yeah, I totally
now,
believe that.
That takes into account, and I will say, I mean, you've sold far more books than I have, so I'm not bragging to you, but I will tell you that my e-books on Amazon sell more than that, so I feel good. Anyway,
yeah.
But also, you know, I mean, that takes, if you think about it, that takes into account on one end the things you were mentioning, the authors you were mentioning, King, Patterson, and I'm sure we could both name a few others, you know.
Yeah.
Not even talking about the evergreens like Hemingway and folks like that. Just, you know, the current authors who are popular,
right.
You know, who put their books in bookstores, they sell vastly more. They may, in fact, sell millions of books in a year. But what that does to the average, what that tells you is that some poor schmuck in Waukegan, Illinois, has his books in a bookstore, but he's selling one a year.
Yeah.
And that's from the remainder table. I mean, you know, it's not an easy business. So the fact that you've done as well as you have is really a testament to the quality of your books and your writing, and also, to some extent, the manner in which you have been involved in merchandising. Okay, and all of that works. It all goes to the same line.
Yeah, I'm with you too. Like 90% of my book sales come from ebooks. I mean,
right.
Like my books are available at Barnes & Noble, but the chance of them actually being on the shelf, you know, there's limited shelf space in the store for all
sure.
the big named authors that are out there. So the chance of someone going in and seeing, I mean, they can always order computer catalog, but the chance that Barnes & Noble actually said, hey, we need to have some Luke Murphy books on our shelves, you know, it's probably pretty slim.
Well, unless, you know, something happens where all of a sudden the three they had sitting there sold all in one day. Now they're going to order more books and give you some more shelf space, you know.
Well, exactly, if that movie day deal ever comes through, eh?
Right, exactly. Then you're off to the races. In Kiss and Tell, you wrote about a character who, in some fashion, is involved with the LAPD. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so, you know, it's funny because I have three novels out. One, the main character is a 6'5", 230-pound African-American man, and the other one is a female character,
right.
And people laugh and said, why are you writing about something that you're not at all? Like, so it's funny. So I'm writing from an African-American's point of view, and then I'm writing now from this female point of view in Kiss and Tell. So the female character was actually the character that my wife and I had created back when she was in university. So that's the one I went with. And, you know, it's a lot of fun to write from a female perspective because I ended up making her a very tomboyish character just to help me get through, instead
right,
of me asking my wife all the time,
ahead.
What would you do if this happened? What would you do if that happened? Yeah, so, you know, I really made her a really hard character. So, you know, she's an alcoholic and, you know, she's highly medicated all the time. She's got a lot of problems in her life. She's lost touch with her family, and she's trying to build those relationships back. And so, you know, she's not your prototypical detective. And so it was a lot of fun to write. And I know a lot of my female readers are always bugging me. They want, you know, another book with Charlene Taylor in it. So, pardon?
I say a Kiss and Tell sequel.
Yeah. My female readers really made a connection with that character, and I think they'd like more, so they'd love a Kiss and Tell sequel. So, and that's certainly something that I've thought about, and you know, might even be my next novel if I ever, you know, get a chance to sit down and actually write again. I might.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions. Besides the Barnes and Noble and the Amazon, you have a website from which people can order books or find out what's going on with you, correct?
Absolutely. It's www.authorlukemurphy, all one word, .com. And, you know, you can order books, my books there. You can just find out what's going on, my schedule, where I'm at, and, just anything about my writing.
By the way, I tried to access that site. It was either today or yesterday. I don't remember which, and it was just hanging for a while. So if other people find that same thing, go back tomorrow or the next day. But I was going to say you may want to take a look at that.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that. I haven't been on it in a few days, so I don't know. Okay, I'll have to check that out. Thanks for mentioning that.
It could be my provider here. Who knows? Did you have to go to L.A. to research Kiss and Tell?
I didn't go to L.A. for that one. Everything was from the internet. And actually,
right.
I got lucky because one of my editors is from L.A. So, you know, he was like, everything, nope, this, you know, what's going on here? He's talking about landmarks. And, you know, he was really good to help me kind of get a feel of being in L.A. and what it looks like and what the scene's like. So.
I was just going to say, that's where I grew up. So if you ever have a question for your next one, feel free to call.
There you go. I can. Are you cheap?
I'm free. You can't get cheaper than that. So,
that's perfect.
Yeah. But anyway, that's great. But so you were talking about having trouble finding time to write. There are a lot of people who listen to the show, or some people who listen to the show, who either are writers or aspiring writers. You are, you know, you're teaching, with all the jobs you have, and with, how many kids do you have?
I have three daughters. And I still have a full head of hair. They haven't hit teenage years yet, though. They haven't hit teenage years yet, though.
All right, well, give your hairline some time. But in terms of your writing at 9 o'clock, are you still being able to do that? Are you able to sit down and actually pick out some stuff at night, or are you just desperately desiring the time that you don't have?
A little of both. I mean, there's some nights like everyone's in bed here by 9 o'clock, so...
Mm-hmm.
Some days I'm just so exhausted, though, from teaching all day and then, you know, tutoring and then family time. But I play hockey Monday nights, so that's out, uh-huh. and I ref Wednesday nights, so that's out, too. So Tuesdays and Thursdays usually are the best nights for me to sit down and write.
Right.
Yeah, I can usually try to pound out a couple of hours after everyone's in bed. But, you know... I'm sure you know this. Some nights it's just not clicking, right? It's not for whatever reason. It's not flowing. The words aren't flowing. It's not working. So the good thing about being only a part-time writer is, you know, you don't have a deadline. I don't have to try to fight that writer's block. I can just shut the computer off and wait for another night. So So winters are definitely a lot tougher. In summers, you know, there's no school. I don't have teaching in the summer, so I've got, you know, a lot more time. Of course, I have the kids home then, too, with me, which isn't the best time. But they're getting older now, and they're starting, well, you know, one. Oh, I still have a four-year-old, so she's still not real independent. But, it's gonna get a little easier every summer. But, it's a tough time right now.
At first, when you said winters are tougher, I'm thinking, why? You can't go anywhere. Well, what else are you going to do?
Well, and especially in Canada, you can't go anywhere. You're snowed in, basically. But, with school on during the day, I don't, and then there's nighttime, too, as a teacher. You still have correcting and prep work and stuff to do. So there's always stuff to do as a teacher. But Christmas holidays are coming up a couple weeks. I have the countdown on, 10 days of school left before the holidays.
Right.
So maybe I'll be able to get a little more, but I am writing here and there. I can't lie and say, you know, I haven't gotten on my computer since the release of Wildcard. But you're in the same boat. I mean, we're not big name authors, so for myself, I'm published with a very small publisher, so I'm doing most of my own promoting. So a lot of my time too has to be dedicated to the promotion part of. You know, my books. I wish I was with the big publisher who had big budgets on marketing and I could let them do it, but unfortunately that's not the case.
We've got about 2 minutes left, but I've talked that's okay. As I say, I've talked to people who do work with big time publishers, and one of the struggles is, yes, they spend lots of money on promotion, but not necessarily on your book.
And it's always
a fight.
Pick and choose.
And one of the things you may want to think about, since you are already published and you've got people on your website, you may want to consider publishing as ebook only the next time. And that way, you know, you're going to be making about $2 a book as opposed to what you're doing now, which I expect to be less.
It's an option. So the publisher I'm with, they make most of those decisions, like, paperback and ebook and the price of it and all that stuff. So. I know a lot of people seem to be going into the self-publishing now. They want more control and they want 100% of the profit, right? Yeah.
Right. Anyway, the website again is authorlukemurphy.com, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And Amazon and Barnes & Noble, in case you can't tell, I'm hurrying to finish up because we've got about 80 seconds left of the show. So I'm going to let you go. Thanks so much for joining us. And, of course, I want to talk to you when the next one comes out.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much, and I was so happy to hear that you were bringing this show back. I was just, I was so disappointed when you said you had to take a break, and I'm so happy you're back.
That's very kind. Thanks very much.
You take care, Jeff.
All right, amigo. Take care. Bye-bye. Okay, and we are about out of time, so thank you for joining us. Next week it's Larry Hancock. Join us then, and patreon.com, and though you're going away, please don't go away mad. Somewhere it's after midnight. Around midnight. Good night, everybody.